Grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer. Well, hello everybody. Welcome to episode 230 episodes of the Dudes and Beer podcast. Now, that is tons and tons and tons of hours of content. Wow, just blows my mind. Thank you for everybody that's been tuning in for years. I am Chris Jordan, your host. We talk about so many things on the Dudes and Beer podcast. One of them that we have covered over the last year with our good friend and scientific advisor, Dr. John Hall, is the opioid crisis. It was one of our bigger episodes this last year as far as ratings, listens, things like that, because our audience is concerned about stuff. That's what's great, is that our audience actively listens to issues like this and chimes in, tries to do something about it in society, in the world, with people that they care about, because the opioid crisis is probably amongst anything that we cover here, be it human trafficking, civil rights violations, things like that. The opioid crisis is probably something that every single American could raise their hand and say, yes, I know somebody. And it's mind-numbing what's out there. We're gonna talk to our guest, Jessica Gerlach, here in just a second.
Jeffrey Epstein, the elite's pedophile pimp, is dead. Something everyone saw coming a mile away, including Epstein himself, who according to the Daily Mail had told guards that someone was trying to kill him. An ex-inmate told the New York Post that it would have been impossible for Epstein to kill himself, yet there is still no way to tell because the staff at MCC has yet to say anything, even though the incident is of grave national importance. When it comes to any American harboring a shred of trust in the government again. We are told Epstein, hanging on to life and soon to suffer cardiac arrest on the way to the hospital, was wheeled out of New York City's Metropolitan Correctional Center around 7:30 a.m., just a day after co-conspirators had been revealed in 2015 court documents and 2016 depositions where Virginia Jeffrey, who told the Mail on Sunday that Epstein loaned her out to the high-profile people and claimed that she had to report back with details relating to blackmail. Jeffrey also revealed how Epstein's madam, Ghislaine Maxwell, pimped Jeffrey out to powerful names for erotic massages and sex, which included modeling agent Jean-Luc Brunel and wealthy financier Glenn Dubin. In those released documents, Dubin's butler recounted the testimony of a Swedish teen who had been held against her will on Epstein's notorious pedo island.
She said they asked me for sex. I said no. The butler was asked, was she in fear? Yes, he replied. You could tell? Yes. She was shaking uncontrollably.
While modeling agent Brunel was accused of supplying Russian teens that didn't speak a word of English. Signs of an international sex trafficking network. Of course, we are supposed to believe the Clinton cleanup crew over at the FBI is on top of it, and the Justice Department. And why did former Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein pop up at the outset of all of this anyway?
Former Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein suggested on Twitter that there might not be more here beneath the surface. He wrote, "Pedophiles facing criminal charges are at high risk for suicide. It happened in several of my Maryland cases when defendants were released on bail. Detained pedophiles require special attention. Stopping people from harming themselves is difficult."
But as Cassandra Fairbanks at the Gateway Pundit reported, there aren't any mainstream media outlets at MCC asking the same question she is.
Do you know why Epstein wasn't on suicide watch?
I do not know.
Do you know if they're going to do a press conference?
I do not know. You'll have to talk to the public information officer as Mr. Ford.
Yeah, I've been trying, but I haven't been able to get through.
Questions like, were the guards that were stationed to watch Epstein told to leave the area due to maintenance? Why did the security cameras mysteriously break during the time of the alleged suicide? Why is there a bruise on Epstein's face? And how did Epstein die exactly? Also, is the case actually over?
If the reports are true, keep in mind these are co-conspirators of his, and they have complainants. So if the complainants aren't focused now on Epstein as he's dead, they're going to focus on anybody else that was involved. And if those other guys were involved, and I'm not saying they were, but according to reports, if that's true, then the investigation just shifts over to them.
It could be made to look like a suicide when it was something else. And I've handled cases like that.
Well, you have?
Yes.
What are they? They look like a suicide and they're not?
Oh, they set the cases up to make it look like a suicide.
In jail?
In jails. And as I've had a couple in jail and outside of jail. And what I would always say to my staff is, until you can prove otherwise, any unattended death is a murder case.
And didn't Ghislaine Maxwell aid and abet? How long before she disappears? And ultimately, how deep does this go? Who did Epstein work for? His wealth and Saudi Arabian passport remain major mysteries. Sure, it's early, but the longer these questions go unanswered, the more the people responsible for the incompetence surrounding Epstein's death create their own undeniable conspiracy. John Bound reporting.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a very good friend of the podcast, Kelly Kasparik, who is out in Hong Kong right now visiting his lovely wife and has called in to us to give us a report about things that are going on over there, what the trip was like, the travel situation, and what the people of Hong Kong are really thinking about this. We get so much in the media over here, but it seems to be a little one-sided and biased. Kelly, if you could, give us a little lowdown, boots on the ground there. What's happening?
So, first of all, it's an honor to be on the show. I appreciate it, Chris.
You're welcome.
I've wanted to get with you for a long time, especially on the sound podcast. That would be way cool because my history in the music business, but cool. I appreciate being on. But the main thing is that this is my second trip here. Wife works here. She's got a contract for another calendar year until 2020. But starting off from when the trip was booked about 5 months out. Of course, always do that for any of you out there trying to get an airplane. Always book 5 months ahead. You'll get the best rates. After that, it was before the issues were starting to come up. Let me back up here and start from the front, from exactly where stuff is starting from, because I know this is right on the plate of everybody's consciousness in the news right now. First and foremost, about 2 years ago or a year and a half ago, there was a murder in Taiwan of a couple that was from Hong Kong. It was a 21-year-old gentleman and his girlfriend took a vacation to Taipei, Taiwan. They were there for 2 days. He ended up murdering his girlfriend in Taiwan and then flying back. And this is on CCTV. You can actually look this up. There's several videos on YouTube where you can find this at. But it shows him leaving, coming to the hotel with his girlfriend and leaving without her. And, it's not a good scene. So as he's leaving without her, he gets back here. And then all of a sudden, hey, where's your old lady? The family's like, where's your girl? She's gone. And they figure out about 4 months in that she's found her body, yada, yada, yada. I don't know all the details, and I can't give you that. And I'm part of the investigation. So I can't give you those details. But to make a short and skinny of this story, the whole thing in a nutshell was that Hong Kong, when he came back here, and he's a citizen of Hong Kong, Taipei, Taiwan wanted to pull him back, and there's no extradition agreement between the two countries to bring that gentleman back for justice. So what happened is that China seen that, and they kind of do some stuff there, mm-hmm. and they've got their, they got their paws in the Taiwan thing. They're like, hey, wait a minute, we're not going to let criminals run into Hong Kong that do stuff in China, because this is happening a lot. There's a lot of people coming to the hospitals from mainland China, filling up the hospitals. They're also coming there as criminals. And, all these things are causing problems because, remember, Hong Kong is probably the size of a third of Texas.
Yeah.
It's very small. Even though it has more high rises than anywhere in the world, it looks huge. It's not. It's very tiny. So anyway, Hong Kong wanted to pull these people out. So in secret how the government works there. You guys can all look this up because it would take another hour to explain how the government works here in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
It's not election stuff. It's not where they elect the people by the people, blah, blah, blah. Some of it is, some of it isn't. Anyway, in a nutshell, these people, you know, mainland China said, you know, we need to figure out a way to get these people to justice, blah, blah, blah. So when they did this and they brought it up to the council in Hong Kong, when that came out, all the young people in Hong Kong and all these, you know, more of the moderate democratic part of the society in Hong Kong said, oh, my God, well, if they do that, they can pull anybody out of Hong Kong and take them to these extreme camps for for all the crazy, wicked, horrific things that they could do like Nazi Germany. So
they're reprogramming
camps. And a big scare.
Yeah,
exactly.
They literally had reprogramming camps.
Oh my God, they could snap. Yeah, so they were like, okay, they can take all these people at any time they want. So everybody freaked out here, and they took to the streets and they started to protest this law. So as your listeners can do, they can go on and get more information than I would give right now. What I want to give you is my viewpoint.
Yeah, yeah, okay, absolutely. So that's what I want to get is the viewpoint of not only you as a traveler, but your family over there. You know, like what, like
yeah,
boots on the ground. What are the people that are living there thinking? We know what the news is telling us. And like you said, we can always look up the backstory. But
yeah, I could tell you the Filipino people that work here. And there's, you know, there's like 50,000, you know, Filipino women working here as OFWs or overseas workers, OFWs, that are here on visas working. And, you know, and the Chinese people love these people because remember, and I'm going to say this, I'll say it again to anybody, that the Filipino workers are the best in the world. Anywhere you go.
Oh, yeah.
If you go to India, if you go to Saudi Arabia, any country in the world will tell you that these are the most dedicated people on the planet, and they work their ass off, and they make very little money. And but anyway, they're the most concerned because, you know, they're working for these people here, and this is their job. They send all this money home to their people, and this is their way of life. So it's very difficult on them because they're stressed every day. What's going to happen? What's going to happen? So as far as boots on the ground, this is, you know, my wife, you know, she's concerned about this. So that's what I see. But, you know, kind of backing up, when I was coming to Beijing, just to let people know about worldly issues, I flew into Beijing for a 4-hour layover. As I was trying to come through security, I have, you know, and I've been to Taipei, I've come through, you know, I've come through all kinds of ports coming to Asia before to go to the Philippines, because I've been to the Philippines 7 times. There's different scrutiny, but I have never felt the paranoia and the more, not anger, but the more like just ready for something to just pop off.
Yeah.
I could feel it going through security, but the hardest issue I had is when I tried to go out to smoke part of a cigar that I had. And yet you as a cigar smoker know, Chris, this is very difficult because, you know, we're like killing mosquitoes with these things. You know, nobody wants us around. So when I try to get out of the terminal, you know, they're like, no visa, no inner, you know, Hong Kong. You know, I mean, no inner China. I was able to do this in Taipei and different other places, but, you know, Beijing was very, very tough. I couldn't leave the terminal.
Oh, wow.
I couldn't even go out to smoke a cigarette. You know, I even asked if I could go out to get a better reception on my phone. They were like, no. The police, the government police, everybody was like, you stay in the terminal, you know, and I'm like, American citizen, you know, is it okay? That doesn't matter to them right now.
Oh, yeah, they don't care.
There's a big, there's, everything is up the level of paranoia and the strictness of movement. And, you know, everybody's really concerned right now. It's a big issue because I think that they look at Hong Kong as that little brother. You know how, like, me and you have a little brother that's kind of like, you know, he's starting to get in trouble and they're concerned for him.
Yeah.
That's what it's looking like here. You know, that's what it does. It's a whole vibe of what the hell's going to happen next with these kids. And that's really what I'm seeing as far as that goes, you know. But once I got in, I was lucky. Like I mentioned to you before we were recording, I did want to mention this. If you watch the news, I was very lucky. On Monday, the start of Monday the 5th or 6th, there was protests that shut down the airport. 33 flights were canceled on that day.
I was worried about you whenever I saw that.
I know. And I had booked this 5 months out, and I got Thursday as my flight in on the 7th. So I was super lucky I made it on the window because they came in on Friday the 8th. 8th, 9th, but today is 9th here. It's actually tonight. It's 10 p.m. on the 9th. Tomorrow's the 10th, you know, Sunday the 10th, and they will be demonstrating all 3 days. So they've actually, you know, slowed the airport down for the last 3 days. So I made it in on the window. So I actually got in, got my room. I'm just, you know, God was looking out for me. Buddha, you know, my eternal power, the person that I, you know, my chosen higher power has gotten me here and gotten me with my wife. So I'm able to do what I do here, and I've gotten here, and I wanted to make sure that I called you and checked in with you and wanted the world to know, the people that listen to your podcast had a boots on the ground look at this thing. This is exactly what's going on. It's a bunch of young people here that are worried about their future. Of course, there's a bunch of older people, adults, that are worried about their future, thinking that the younger people are going to make it worse. And then you've got the triads and the gangsters right in the middle trying to whip everybody's ass with sticks in red because nobody wants to behave. And the triads feel like they've got to straighten stuff out.
Yeah, you were actively saying, but and that's the thing, folks. That's what we don't realize. Like, here we have mass protests or riots like this, and sure, the police come in. There, it's beyond the police. The triads have more control of the streets than the police, and they'll be damned if they're going to see bloodshed on their street if it's not them doing it. That's just how that works.
If you watch the videos of them from last week, where they actually entered the MTR and started whipping the kids in white shirts.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, holy crap.
Like you said, before we started recording, you had to go out and buy new clothes so that you were not wearing triad colors of any sort to make sure that they all knew I am neutral. Don't jack with me. I'm not wearing red. I'm not wearing white. Not wearing black.
Yeah, our wardrobe is black.
It's all black.
Me and you, we got like probably 5,000 shirts in our closet that are black. You know, and the first thing was about a month ago. My wife was like, "You have to get all neutral colors." I'm like, "Cool." So no whites, no blacks, no reds. I'm in all right now. I'm wearing like a mauve, you know, like and I've got a white shirt,
turquoise.
But I sleep in it. It's my night shirt.
All turquoise and fuchsia.
Yeah, exactly. Turquoise or earth tones. I'm all earth tones. Yeah. So, but you know, just to get you up to the moment, tomorrow will be a rally, and they've put a bunch of this stuff on Facebook.
Yeah.
There's a really good website called Dim Sum News, which is. It's pretty left-wing. It's pretty pro-kids, you know, that are protesting right now because it's giving you the opinion from their side. Hong Kong Daily News is going to give you kind of the adult side, you know, the parents, some of the business owners, stuff like that. And then if you go with a couple of the other, like, economic papers, they're going to go with several of the more of the police view. So you've got about, you know, the cool thing about Hong Kong, people need to realize this, and what I love about Asia, is that the division in the United States with CNN and Fox and how the line is drawn in the center with Dems, left-wing, and right-wing conservatives, you have more of a broader scope here of that look in Hong Kong.
Mm.
If only the world could be more like this city, because it is so compact. You would think that it's such an explosive atmosphere, but it's not. You look down the street. When I walk out this morning and I look down the street, I could never tell that this city is on fire with an issue, because everybody just walks by each other. And, you know, Chinese are not the first to be like, "Oh, hello, how are you?" and all that. You know, it's always a cold atmosphere, always. But in the back of their mind is, You know, as they're walking down the street, we're going to make this work. We're going to make this work.
That's what we were saying before broadcast, was that, you know, these people have civility in society on a lockdown. You know, like they've been doing this society thing since before the time of Christ, people.
Absolutely.
If you're talking about a polite society that knows how to at least get along with each other despite any political views or whatnot, you're looking at them. Go to the Asiatic countries. They've been at this for a good clip now. They got a lockdown on how to deal with these things.
And, you know, tonight, as I was coming back from my wife's boss's apartment, you know, from where the couple, they, they have their apartment in the mid-levels. If any of your listeners want to look at the mid-levels on a map in Hong Kong, this is where all the more of the upper middle class have their high rises. These are 30 to 50 story towers on the mountain going up towards Victoria Peak, which is the tallest peak in Hong Kong, which if you've ever looked at pictures of Hong Kong, the most picturesque, beautiful, high rise cluster, that's where they are. But as I'm coming down the mountain and I'm looking at how close these buildings are, and it's just a 2-lane road squirreling up the top. You know, you would think that people would be yelling out the window, "You suck, turn down your music," all that. You know, these people have learned how to fucking get along in such a small, tiny space. And yeah. And we live on acres, and we're like, fuck you.
Yeah.
You know
what God, I mean? I hate my neighbor, man. He's like a quarter mile over there just wrecking it all the time. Yeah. I hate that guy. Oh, yeah. There's signs in his yard. You know?
Yeah, and it's a trip like that, man. They've got it like that here, and I think they'll figure it out. You know, I think at the most, the thing is that China, to me, this is just my opinion, I don't think for a moment that they want to take this thing from anybody, because Hong Kong has a special look to the world.
Yeah.
And it reflects on China. Of course, China has a look now that, because the United States, and I'll tell you exactly what happened. During Obama, China came up so fast and so furious in their economy, all their money. They did so well during Obama because there was such a bad deal for us economically. They were able to come up so fast. Yeah. And now that we have Trump and it's kind of leveled off, and now we have the tariffs and there's that little war going back and forth, you know, things are leveling off and it's kind of that poker game from, what was that movie with Jackie Gleason and Paul Newman,
The Sting.
I forgot the name of that, where they were gambling, or the pool game, where they were all like, now we're all on the same table. Yeah. The Hustler. We're on the same, everybody's dealing the same now, which, I'm kind of thankful for, because I thought that we were way too distant with Asia back when Obama was there. But yeah, I mean, you had a president who wasn't, he wasn't a foreign relations guy. You know, he wasn't that guy. So, but anyway, without getting political on that side, I think now, it's a situation where I think all the countries want to look better than they actually are. I don't think anybody wants to look bad to the world.
Yeah.
So I don't really think, in my opinion, that this is going to go south. I think what's going to happen is there's just going to be a lot of sword rattling. And as long as that's the case, I'm happy with that. I don't see a China that wants to say, all right, well, one country, two systems, which should be the breadth of this conversation between me and you about Hong Kong, because that's really what it is here. It's one country, two systems, that would change by any means. And, and at the same time, Chris, I've only got one more, me and my wife only have one more year, and then we moved to the Philippines. And of course, we're buying property there, and I'll be traveling back and forth for shows here. But, and I won't really have any more to deal with in Hong Kong, but my heart is in the city. And I hope and pray, and I always say that on my Facebook to everyone, please pray for the people here.
Yeah,
of course, they need your spirit. We want this to be a country on earth which is unlike anything. What this reminds me of, Chris, is why I've always loved it. It's, Blade Runner, of course, and Alien are my two favorite movies in the history of mankind. But this Blade Runner feel to the city is unlike anywhere on the planet. Once you come here, and if you love that science fiction, that look, when you come here, you'll be like, oh, shit, this is it.
Yeah, it is very tech-noir.
It becomes your favorite city on the planet. Oh, it is. And when you come, and when you see it and you're here and it gets in your skin, dude, you want to come back here again and again. And I'm hoping someday I can sneak you and your wife or get your ass over here to visit, you know?
We've definitely talked about it. And I've known you for years and years, Kelly. And I don't know that I've seen you more excited than when I've seen you talking about Hong Kong and going over there to see your lady, everything else, man. It has truly changed your life. Even the card that you gave me on show, I still keep that in my wallet, and that has utterly changed my perspective. Thank you, my man.
Yeah. It's a place everyone should visit if they're into tech noir or they're into science fiction. If because there's nowhere on the planet like this, period. Yeah. So, you know, in summation of what I've got for you, there's going to be some, there's another date tomorrow for the rally at the airport. There's one more day there. And then everybody, you know, kind of goes back to work on Monday. You know, they had a 3-day sitting, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And then, of course, tonight at Taipo, they were supposed to go to the police station. I haven't done an update right now. I was looking at dim sum. Maybe some of your listeners can look on, you know, because, of course, this tape is going to be played later.
Yeah.
They can keep track through dim sum news, and they can get kind of the left-wing look at things, you know, from the kid on the ground.
Yeah,
and get a look at that. But as I look at the, I've got a little map for the hotspot. It looks like the only thing they're going to do is Taipo tomorrow, or tonight and tomorrow, and then everything kind of settles down till the 11th. On the 11th, there's supposed to be a big rally in Central. But of course, all the stuff that I've done, that I'm doing here, is going to be scheduled outside the city. That's why I brought the bike, you know, the assault bike for the convention stuff. So I'm going to try to get out of the city and do that. But yeah, that's basically what I've got for now.
Well,
know, and of course, I'll stay in touch. And if you need info, you know, you can call me anytime or email me anytime, and I'll get back with you ASAP.
Hey, thank you so much for taking the time away from your family while you're over there, Kelly, and away from your trip while you're over there to call in, give us a report, boots on the ground, what's happening over there. Thank you so much. And yeah, we'll chat at you soon, my friend.
You got it. Hey, call me whenever. But in the meantime, for your listeners, go online, check out the stuff, but always be supportive of the Hong Kong people. Keep them in your prayers. Keep them in your thoughts, because these are a peaceful, wonderful, loving people that were, you know, they were suitored by, you know, the English. And for a long time, you know, the English came here and said, you know what, this can be a great place for trade and a great place for peace loving, you know. And it's very unique, because everybody here, you can be of any race and walk down the street and nobody looks at you funny. So it's a really good place in the world, and keep it in your thoughts and your prayers. Yeah, of course. And God bless you and you and your kids, and, you know, give the little man a big old nudge, and, you know, keep Gort out of the issues. You know what I mean?
No, man. Gort is agnostic with all of
it. He needs to stay on the political stuff.
That's right. So thank you so much for taking the time, Kelly.
You got it, Chris. Love you. Good night. God bless. And call me when you need me, all right?
All right, bud. She is the owner and founder of Milano Marco Entertainment. She is in Serbia right now, and she is an opioid crisis advocate, as well as one of the people who is trying to make the movie 16. The movie is about, well, we'll let Jessica tell us a little bit about it. Here is a clip from the movie 16 from the trailer.
No, I don't want to leave any track marks.
Clear!
I stand here today as your elected official to let you know that we have an enemy among us. That enemy is opioid addiction.
There's something really, really wrong with our daughters.
Like
I'm thinking maybe it could be drugs. Their appearance has changed. Their behavior has changed.
I don't know where you're coming up. I know my daughter, she would never.
As long as this paper out there.
There is some of the audio from the amazing trailer for the upcoming movie 16, still in production. Let's welcome Jessica Gerlach to the show to talk about this amazing film, as well as her advocacy against the opioid crisis. Welcome, Jessica. How are you today?
Hi, Chris. I'm doing well, thanks. How are you?
Doing great. Such a moving and stirring 5 minutes of media. That trailer. I love the quote that it starts off with. The statistic as of 2010, over 12 million Americans reporting using prescription medications for non-medical purposes. Like I said in the intro, such a stirring topic in our society today. How did you get involved with your advocacy against opioids?
Well, that's an interesting story. So a good friend of mine, Gerald Barclay, we've been writing together and producing and all of it in the film industry for about 20 years now. So I met him when I was 18. I actually did my first film as an actress, my first indie film for him that he was directing. So after that, we stayed really good friends. We began writing about all different types of topics on different projects. He always included me. He pretty much is the reason I got started in creative writing on that level in the film industry. So after many projects, we ended up writing a book together a couple years ago about Wu-Tang Clan. He grew up with them, and he did a bunch of their first music videos when they started out in the 90s, unbelievably. So he actually called me up. I was in Serbia. He was in Atlanta, where he lives. And he said, I have this great idea for a project. I'm too busy right now. I know you can just take it and run with it. And then when he told me what the topic was about, I had to remind him that I knew so many people who were affected by the opioid epidemic, by the opioid issue crisis, whatever you want to call it. I mean, it's been such an issue for so many years now. So I reminded him that, yeah, did you remember that? I'm so close to so many people who have been affected by it, and I've lost a lot of loved ones as well and friends. And he said, you know, I must have subconsciously remembered that because I thought of you right away. Aside from the fact that he obviously trusts me when it comes to writing, and we know each other's writing style and what to expect and all that for the most part. So it was originally supposed to be a short film. And once he gave me the topic, I mean, I just had so much material. The creativity was just pouring out of me. Not to mention, I had so many real life actual event stories in my head, in addition to all of the scenarios that obviously as a creative person, I was seeing that we could portray our story as real, raw, and realistic as possible. So that being said, I literally handed him back pages and pages of material. And he was just like, damn, girl, we're going to have to make this a feature film. And I was like, amazing. Like, I'm totally up for it. So yeah, we just continued developing it from there. And then shortly after that, I was booking a trip to New York for the summer with my kids. That was last summer. And we decided to shoot the 10-minute short version, which is like a proof of concept to show what we're trying to do with this. And we were originally supposed to film that in Staten Island, but I expressed to Gerald that it would mean a lot to me if I could film this in my hometown, where obviously I went to high school, but I had lost so many loved ones and friends to this epidemic. And I knew that the town was still struggling with the issue, like so many towns in the U.S. I'm not just targeting that town of Port Jervis, but it's in many, many, many small towns. Anyway, he backed me on it 100%. He was all for it. And literally we started planning and, you know, doing castings and scouting locations. We literally pulled it together in about 3 weeks. So he was in Atlanta, so I basically had to try to pull the community together as fast as possible because I wanted to involve the community as much as possible in the project. And amazingly, I had so much support from the town. It was unbelievable. So the mayor of the town was in my film. He's the guy who speaks and does the speech at one of the children's funerals. In the film, he's throughout the film, he's speaking about a lot of the statistics, and he's playing a mayor in the film as he is in real life. And yeah, like I said, you know, a lot of family friends, owners of the funeral home, family friends of ours, they were super supportive. They let us film there. I filmed at the middle school. I had ambulances, donating their trucks to us and their vehicles and staff. And it was just incredible. So literally the whole town came together, and a lot of my best friends from, you know, that I grew up with came to, you know, help me out with this. So that's actually how it started. And yeah, that's literally how it came together. It was planned in about 3 weeks as far as the filming stage, the pre-filming stage. So.
Yeah. And it's beautiful to hear communities coming out, to not only support the arts and projects like this, but to bring these messages out to their community. But like I said, I would challenge you to find anybody that doesn't know someone that has been affected by the opioid crisis. Whether it's somebody who went down the wrong path with their prescription meds, someone who had an addiction years ago that a prescription med resurfaced because of post-surgery, something like that. Like that's one of the big statistics that we demystified with Dr. John Hall, was that, yes, there are tons of people out there who are turning to this, but most of the people that are turning to hard, hard street drugs from their prescription meds are people who had hard street drug problems years ago. Like I said in our pre-conversation a couple weeks ago, it would be hard for my mother who takes, who's allowed up to 8 to 9 hydrocodones a day, to know which back alley in Katy, Texas to go down to find heroin. But just about everybody, under the age of 40 knows somebody that they could get a Xanax from if they needed one for an airplane ride. Just about everybody knows somebody that they could get an OxyContin from or a hydrocodone from if they slipped a disc in their back, you know? And that's the proof of the pudding there is the fact that especially people in their 20s to late 30s, early 40s, this is the range of people that has been so hard hit by this epidemic. It's not necessarily people in their 60s who are taking their meds as prescribed by their doctors, despite how many they're given a day. They aren't the ones that are out there committing suicide. They aren't the ones out there grabbing up prison records from crime.
Unfortunately, yeah, I mean, it's not that you don't have addicts at all that age, but it's not as prevalent, definitely. I think I absolutely agree with what you're saying about, you know, that certain age group, let's say between the age of 16 to 40. You know, I've seen it at my events when we're at the public speaking events, we're talking about the opioid epidemic. We share the film trailer and all that, and we always do an interactive session at the end. And it's unbelievable how many people raise their hands when we ask them, do you know somebody who's been affected by this issue? And yeah, it's that common. I mean, when you have 130 people dying a day, you know, from it, the U.S., you know, the statistics are super high. And also the fact that you have a better chance of dying of an opioid overdose at this point than you do from a car accident.
Yeah.
It's really revealing.
That's
about
kinda,
how bad this issue.
That's more than scary. That should be an earth shaking statistic for people. Literally.
Yeah.
That should be an earth shaking statistic to know that 130 people a day are dying from opioids in America.
Yeah, about approximately 47,000 people died in just the year 2017. It's out of control. It's really, really out of control.
Now, whenever you are out speaking at college campuses, things like that, this is just an honest question. Do you see or hear a lot of follow-up from the universities that you go to?
It all depends.
I don't want you to out any universities, but like as a former teacher, coming from a family of teachers, you know, It's something that whenever you go, like, you can go to all the school, like, school assemblies all you want all day, but if you don't go back and discuss it, if you don't have a week of curriculum based on that, you know, it can
unfortunately
be...
I don't know what they do with it from there, but we always do give our information out. So if anybody wants to contact us by email or any of it, I will say this. I have had a physician come up on stage, which I have talked about in other interviews. And basically, I stayed in touch with him for a while, and you mentioned the suicide issue. So he's affiliated, that physician is affiliated with a reverend who literally takes in addicts who are also at risk of suicide or have had suicidal thoughts or what have you. And basically, he takes them in and tries to give them like a sense of bond and loving environment and emotional connection that he believes that they're lacking, and that's why they're addicts. But so I did stay in touch with certain types of people at the events. It's just, it varies. It's all different. He actually came up on stage and told us that as a physician, the medical communities were led to believe by the pharmaceutical companies that these drugs were less than 1% chance, that opiates were less than 1% chance addictive. And he came on stage and literally, you know, wanted to let us know, like, these are 100% chance of addiction.
Yeah.
So it was just really amazing to have a physician come up on stage and share a little bit of his story at the end to kind of just back us in what we're trying to tell people.
Well, and it's just so, I mean, to hear that from a doctor is just so the case. Regularly. I know I work quite a few medical conventions every year, and it's always interesting whenever I'm sitting in on a conference on SRIs, you know, serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And they still don't know. Literally. They have no idea why when prescribed the exact same medication for the exact same symptoms for you and me, it might work for me. It might do something totally different for you. They don't even know why it works. And yet still they're just doling it out. And it's like, wow. When you sit there and hear doctors literally say, like, we have no idea why this works the way it does. But if it's giving you results with your patients, you know, keep using it. And it's like, what? What the what?
They go blind. Undiscovered territory there, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's also, the issue is that it's not being prescribed to, like, teenagers, for example, but they're taking it because they want that euphoric high or escape from reality. And my message to them is like, well, my message to them is through my film, really, because in this film, you know, it tells the story of a 16-year-old Gianna and her friends, and they're a group of high-achieving, healthy, vivacious teenagers who literally innocently dabble in the use of some pills, which ultimately leads them down to, you know, to the dark underworld of heroin and fentanyl addiction. So we see, you know, prostitution, criminal activity, murders, robberies gone wrong, overdose, hepatitis C, HIV, like all of it in this film. And that's the thing. It's like, if I could just, you know, tell a 16-year-old, like, you're not just taking a pill today and you're just, you know, going to be over it and done with it tomorrow. It's not like smoking weed or getting drunk where, I mean, I'm not condoning anything really.
Yeah,
here.
No.
I'm just saying that there are certain things that you can do that the next day, you know, you might have a hangover and then you're over it. Well, after a few days of taking these pills, you know, the 16-year-old is not going to be like, hey, let me pop this pill today and another one tomorrow. And like in 6 months from now, I might be prostituting myself to support my addiction. They can't, they don't think like that.
No, no. So, the chain of events in a brain that young just does not work that way. And what's interesting is that Texas actually just bumped up its smoking age to 21.
Oh,
in this last election, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, There were a bunch of people up in arms about it and everything. Oh, you know, 18, you know, this and that. And I was like, you know what? Here's the thing. I don't think anybody's brain, and you know, I'm not going to say that I don't. Quite honestly, my audience knows me and knows that the day it's legal in Texas, the name of the show will probably be rebranded to Dudes and Reefer.
Yeah.
However, all that aside, even with my proponency for legalized marijuana, I would never say that anybody under the age of 21 should be doing it. I would never say that anybody under the age of 21 should be smoking cigarettes, or even serving in the military, or even serving in the military for that matter, because I don't think that your brain has gelled to the point of life and death consequence yet and long-term impact. It hasn't. And like, physiologically, we know this.
Yeah, I agree with that. So were you talking about the legalization of, in Texas, you're saying they can't smoke cigarettes under the age of 21? Or were you talking about weed?
Cigarettes. Nobody can smoke weed. Nobody can smoke weed in Texas. Okay. Don't do that, people. Okay. Don't do that. If you do, call JL. call JL Carpenter. She's one of the official lawyers that comes on our show and talks about stuff. So call JL if you get in trouble, people. But don't be going out and purposefully disobeying the law in public and things like that. All right? And that's the thing. Go ahead. Go ahead.
No, it was a little break for me. So I thought, no, I know that in some states it's legalized and some it's not. So that's, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And, those are decisions for grown folk. I find it very interesting because you and I are right up around the same age. I know when I was a kid, it wasn't until I saw the after school special that I knew I could go behind the alley in the Kroger and get drugs, you know? And it's one of those, like, how often do we demystify this just within our culture? You know, like, look at the fact of, I don't watch a lot of broadcast TV whenever I'm home, but whenever I'm on the road, that's pretty much what I got in my hotel room. And I challenge you to go through a commercial break without a drug. I challenge you.
Yeah. You
feeling sad? Not feeling good? Take this.
That's the culture that we live in, unfortunately. You know, that's literally how it is.
Yeah, we didn't have those commercials as kids, so we didn't know, like, hey, reach in the cabinet for something to make you feel better, unless it was Pepto-Bismol or something like that, you know? And I think a lot of it does have to do with our culture. It has to, because... I mean, the UK has access to these same medications, but they don't nearly have the opioid rate that we do.
Right. In the US, it's, you know, just out of control. So,
yeah.
I mean, I don't serve anybody taking them in Serbia. I really don't.
Yeah.
But this is a tiny little country, so it's a really difficult thing to compare. But I really don't hear about it here. Of course, there's heroin in Belgrade and in some of the cities.
There are some hard drug problems in many places in Eastern Europe, you know, methamphetamine, good God, the cocodril or whatever it was that was taken over a few years ago.
Well, that's more so, I think that came from Russia from what I understand.
Yes, it did.
But
it
yeah,
did.
I haven't but, seen any of that here, but other Eastern European countries, it's possible. Yeah.
Well, and even now, the reports, like, good God, there was a sheriff that had to come out a few weeks ago and say, hey, kids, stop trying to use this wasp killer in place of your meth.
Brutal.
Like, oh, my God. It's strange the way that we deal with addiction in this country. How often have you seen, whenever you're out speaking with schools, speaking with universities, things like that, how often do you have people approaching you talking about themselves being addicted, friends, family members, things like that. And how have they been able to deal with that?
Unfortunately, a lot of people that come to me are not people who are addicted at the time. They're usually addicts who, you know, did get clean, but they have had a lot of issues with relapse. And this is one of those drugs that has a really high relapse rate, unfortunately.
Yes, it does.
But from what I hear, there are new type of, alternative therapies that are coming out that are supposed to help, but, you know, they're still in the developmental stages. So I don't think they're all that sure about how that's going to go yet. But yeah, I think that a lot of people that do come forward, like in a conference, like a colleges type of conference, or just at a college in general, are people who have had friends who struggled with it or family members. So they seem to be showing up in a way that seems to me like, how do I deal with this? Or how do I help my friend or this person I care about? So, and unfortunately, if they're not a mother and child, you can't force people to do anything.
Yeah.
If they're 18 years old, you know, you can only help them with support and the tools. But even with support, it's such a fine line, you know, because there's a fine line because you can literally be enabling them.
Yeah.
You know, if you think, oh, I'm going to support them and let them live in my house and give them money when they need this and this or that.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, you're just enabling an addict.
And
so,
it's
really tough.
Like you said, that's a fine line. And I will always be there emotionally for people.
Right.
You need somebody to talk to. You thinking about calling somebody else for some nefarious reason, feel free to give me a shout. I'll put down whatever I'm doing. That's where I stand on things. But yeah, like you said, I've been part of the case where it's like, yeah, you know, sure, man, you can sleep on my sofa for a couple nights, you know, till your girlfriend lets you back in the house or whatever, and I'll let her know that you've been sober and whatnot. And then it turns into something totally else. It turns into the fact that they aren't able to keep a job, that they continuously turn back to that same decision. And it's hard because, yeah, most of the time, especially with addiction, until somebody is ready, until they're done with it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we won't be. And that's sad. It's sad because it is a decision. And it's so hard. It's so hard. And I think that what we as a society, much like with all the violence going on, I think that we have to take about 8 steps back, stop politicizing and say, hey, what's the actual problem?
Right.
You know, why are we trying to anesthetize ourselves to begin with?
I think it goes back to that lack of emotional connection.
Yeah.
Maybe growing up or the society we live in doesn't promote a lot of bonding with families anymore. You know, people are on their phones. It's like technology has literally infiltrated our society.
Oh, absolutely.
So
it isolates it. There's more than one study that comes out annually that we cover on this show that talks about how technology isolates us instead of bringing us together.
Literally.
And
it's really sad. Like, I even have to tell my kids, like, I don't let them watch anything, no phones at the dinner table. I want to hear what's going on in your life. Let's talk, let's laugh, let's, you know, and just try to, as busy as we get, you know, it's so important to, like, go for bike rides or go hiking or spend time with your kids so they feel that sense of safety, connection, and support. And luckily I have the knowledge I do from, you know, the type of research and things that I'm interested in, that I really make an extra effort to make sure I do have that quality time with them so they don't feel alone or isolated or a lack of a bond, I guess you could say. So I think it requires a lot of effort on the parents' part, as busy as we all get. I know it's hard, and I know a lot of people don't have it easy. But it's so important to give them that, or else they feel empty inside. And when somebody feels empty, you better bet they're going to, you know, if they get high and they get a taste of that feeling, it's going to be a done deal, unfortunately. And then also on the flip side, I think we've had this conversation earlier, but it's like people who are highly empathic and just very sensitive or highly sensitive people also struggle with that as well.
Yeah.
Because the world of highly sensitive people can be sensory overload. And this is a way of escaping all of those, you know, feelings that they feel are like almost dumped on them.
Yeah. Well, and because as opposed to many things like marijuana, alcohol, that kind of stuff, opioids, and specifically once you start going down the rabbit hole of fentanyl, things like that, those are right up against being dissociatives, like dissociative anesthetics. So it's literally meant to separate you from that. It's meant to numb your nerve endings so that you don't feel things. It's specifically meant for that. And it's interesting because there's a scientist who's been making the circuit, and I've been wanting to get him on the show. I need to start trying to Google stalk him and find him, but there have been many people that have been sharing his presentation where he's talking about the studies that were done on cocaine and rats and addiction in rats years ago were totally done wrong.
And oh, wow. I have to check that
it
out.
It was because they were using isolated rats. When you put rats are not naturally an isolated species. They live in small community. So when you get them into a small community, you can provide them with the cocaine water and the non-cocaine water. And every once in a while, they may go over and take a bump. But it's literally like one out of 40 or 50 times that they go to get a drink of water.
Yeah.
They go over there. They may have a little bit for fun, but they ain't doing it out of sheer addiction. Whereas whenever they're in a cage by themselves and provided the same two bottles of water, they will go to that cocaine water every time.
Wow. I mean, that makes total sense.
And it's a really, really interesting study and point of fact, just that, like, if you take social animals and isolate them, they want a way to numb that pain of being isolated.
And that's exactly what we are. I mean, people crave bonding and belonging and intimacy and, you know, all of that stuff. Like, we're meant to be a society that interacts and supports each other, and I feel like human beings crave that and need that.
Yeah,
I mean, it even goes back to, you know, this is going way, way back, but you know, with when you're a first time mom, you read all these books and they tell you when you're nursing, it's really important to have your baby like skin to skin, because that's a huge part of the bonding process.
Oh, even fathers are told now, take your shirt off, hold your baby.
Totally.
They need to smell smell your flesh. They need to know what dad smells like.
Yeah. I agree with all of that.
Absolutely. Well,
big advocate for that.
I think it goes even further than that, though, Jessica. And it, like I told you in our original conversation with Steve, whenever I was telling you the preface of this show, the preface of this show and why it's called Dudes and Beer is based on our founding fathers. And they had this beautiful society at one point where didn't matter who you were, there was a public house in town. Everybody drank at that public house, from rich to poor. And we talked about things. We exchanged ideas freely over mead, over an ale. And then we went and we shared property lines. And it didn't matter if we disagreed or agreed or not in that house of pub where we were imbibing. When you needed food during the winter, man, I had extra meat. When my family needed firewood, you gave us a cord. Didn't matter who you voted for.
Yeah.
And then when we went back to town, we still went to the same pub and occupied the same stools and talked about the same thing. We don't do that anymore. We don't do that anymore. Instead, we go to the coldness of social media. I am one of those big people with business where it's like, man, if you want to talk, if you want to exchange a contract or follow up on what we just talked about, feel free to email. Aside from that, let's get away from cold words on a screen and actually hear the unction in each other's voice. You'd be surprised what the timbre of somebody's voice does for you actively understanding what they mean.
Absolutely. People, I mean, tone, energy, all of it.
Exactly.
You know, pitch. There's so many.
And when it's see it on a screen, it can be taken so many ways. So many ways you know, that did not have that inflection.
I agree. It's funny that you know this topic is coming up because as a person who's, you know, studied hypnosis and NLP, body language is a huge thing. You know, most of our communication is actually not even done with words.
No.
I think 70% of it is done by, you know, gestures, body language,
it's,
all that.
It's body language and micro expressions. Micro expressions in our face. You know?
Exactly.
Yeah. And that even goes down to where we're at as a society and whether or not you're even approachable as a person.
Mm-hmm.
Like literally, literally. I remember my seventh grade year. There was an interesting program that they started at my junior high, and it started at a few junior highs. It was kind of a pilot program, and they took kids from it was a specialized class during the school day, where they took kids from basically different social cliques. Like there were a couple popular kids, there were a couple of nerdy kids, like different ethnic backgrounds and everything else. And we got together and we went out and did like homeless outreach and things like that. And basically like learned to put all of the other crap that was going on in the school politically amongst our groups aside and realized that like, hey man, if we all do something together, look at what we can do. Like we all got together and made these bags and then we went to the battered women's shelter and gave them as gifts to the kids for Christmas. Did you see their faces? Did you see what we just did?
Wonderful.
As a group of people who normally in the lunchroom would never, ever hang out together.
Right, because you have cliques in high school. You have, that's of course. Unfortunately, it's funny that you say that too, because I remember I was one of those people who like, I hung out with so many different types, like groups. Because if I clicked with somebody, I liked them. And if I saw somebody picking on them, I would get really angry and be like, why are you doing that? That's so not cool. You know, and then one girl will be like, oh, why are you hanging out with that girl? She hangs out with those people. I'm like, who cares? She's cool. Like, I like her, and you should probably try to give her a chance, because she never did anything bad to you.
Exactly. And that's what totally led me down the road in high school of whenever I saw those things, I stood up. Exactly.
Yeah.
I stood up, and I was like, hey, man, you know, like, you're making fun of this dude for what he's wearing. I remember what your mom used to make you wear, because, like, our moms worked together. They made the same amount of money. You know, why are you making fun of that guy just because maybe he can't afford the little lizard on his collar, you know, stuff like that. And like it's interesting where we've come as a society and yet still we wonder why people want to numb themselves. you know?
Yeah. You know, I never, you know, I'm not blaming parents at all, of course. I mean, not in every case. And every person makes their own decisions. But I think we can only do the best we can as parents. And then at some point, you know, kids start to make their own decisions. But, you know, we got to try to do the best we can while they're still little.
That's right.
And so that they feel that, like, massive sense of support. Like, I feel really grateful. My kids, you know, they're almost 11 and 13.
Yeah.
Couple more months, and they're boys, and they tell me stuff that I never dreamed that they would talk to me about, and that's because I never shame them.
That's right.
And I really believe it's because I never shame them. If they tell me something, I'm like, you know what, there's nothing wrong with you, there's nothing wrong with your friends, it's totally normal to be curious, especially at your age, about different things or whatever, but it's probably not that healthy for you, so you might want to choose a better path, and here's what I think, and this is my opinion. And, you know, when I was in New York the last time, when I came back, they were like, you know, mommy, it's so quiet when you're not here. I'm like, is that because I talk a lot?
Yeah.
And they were like, well, yeah, but it's also because you talk to us about everything. And when we ask you things, you're interested and you think about it and you give us your opinion. And like, we really like that. And I was just like, wow, that was like the most rewarding conversation ever.
Yeah.
So it does make me happy to feel like it makes me hope that and feel like maybe I'm on the right track with them. Like I said, we can only do the best we can.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And we can only lead by example. That's it. I've got a 2-year-old and I people are like, my God, you're going to make him into a little tech. You're going to warp his mind. And I'm like, no, what I'm doing is giving the boy options. I was like, at some point, see, I was told to stop inventing. I was told to stop fiddling with wires. I was told to grow up and put that stuff aside. I was told to go to college, get a degree, do something with yourself. Playing with all those wires ain't going to do nothing. I now get paid money to travel around the country and play with people's wires.
You see? Yep.
I am surrounded by racks of equipment in my home studio right now. For both fun and business purposes. It's what I do for a living. Had people actively looked at me and said, hey, this kid's into wires. All right. Prime example, my dad, 3 Christmases ago, had a 15-year-old nephew who wanted to build his own computer for Christmas, wanted to build his own gaming rig. So my dad, being an older gentleman, started just sending my brother ads from, like, hey, yeah, is this one good? I'll get it for him. And I went out for a beer with my dad, and I'm like, hey, man, you know, see, you're trying to help out with Nate's computer. He's like, yeah, I sent Randy a few computers, but he keeps sending them back to me, you know, telling me he's not going to get them. I don't know why not. They're good machines. I'm like, here's the thing. You've got a 15-year-old kid that wants to build his own computer from scratch.
Yeah.
I was like, let me put it in your terms. If I had asked you for a car, or if I had asked you to help me build a car, which one would you have preferred? You know, would you have preferred me to say, let's go to the used car lot? Or would you preferred me to say, hey, Dad, let's buy this old junker and fix it up, man. Let's soup this thing up.
Of course.
It's like, you've got a 15-year-old. I was like, you understand what people pay people to build them a computer? As much as the computer costs.
Well, let's be real. In this day and age, and a 15-year-old saying that, when, you know, a lot of them are really, they have such a sense of entitlement, it's unreal.
Yeah.
So that's even more outstanding.
Exactly.
So
I was like, if you want to do something with your $500, give them a $500 Amazon gift card and say, go nuts.
Yeah.
If you're willing to buy him a $500 computer to do that, which is cool, I'm not going to say don't do it. But I'd say enable him. And that's the thing, is that we use this word enabling in such a horrible way. And I think it's because, yeah, we're used to addiction and the using it in that term. But there are good ways to enable children to have coping mechanisms in society. There are good ways to enable them where you're enabling them with knowledge. You're enabling them with wisdom. You're enabling them with empathy, where it's, yes, your friend made a bad decision. No, that does not mean your friend is a bad person.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, also when you see a kid like that who obviously has an interesting mind, intricate enough to want to build a computer, it's really bad. It's a really unfortunate thing not to to inspire the kids to develop that more, because that could lead to some kind of engineering, or, I mean, who knows what the kid is capable of.
Like I said, that's a career path. That's a career path.
Yeah.
If anything, you've enabled him for the fact of when he gets older and has a computer and it breaks, he knows how to fix it. And then he doesn't have to pay somebody to fix his own computer.
Yeah, but if he's thinking about building computers at 15, he's going to be thinking about even a lot more.
He's stepping into the AV industry with Uncle Chris here and there, and he's wanting to get into maybe programming websites, things like that. Absolutely. I enable those things all the time. I will never not encourage somebody to learn something if they want to learn it.
Building people's, like, because everybody has different gifts.
Yeah.
Natural gifts.
Well, and I think it's just, you know, especially whenever we're talking about opioids, those kind of things, and what lead down those roads, aside from the cases where people have had surgery and that leads to addiction, you know, people like Rush Limbaugh, that kind of stuff. I went and I had a stomach staple done and they gave me this or a back surgery, I think it was. And then they gave me OxyContins and I just got ragingly addicted to them for years.
Oh yeah. That,
you know, and I think we really need to, aside from that part in our society, we need to try and cultivate some kind of inner happiness, inner peace, self-satisfaction with our life and what we do.
Yeah, I agree. And that brings me to a really good point where, you know, I'm working on a new event with my partner, colleague, Brandon Dawson. He used to be the dean at Elmira College, but he's moving on to other things now. But basically, we are putting together an event, which is, it's a motivational resilience type of event, but I think it could be for anybody who wants to literally rewire their brain in a more positive direction, in any kind of way, whether it be success or addiction or just overall, you know, feeling happier, any of that. And one of the things that I do discuss in that event and the book that we're writing together is finding the tools that you need. Like, there, we have access to all of these different tools, like meditation, hypnosis, for example, which I'll offer at these events. At the end of the event, we'll probably do some like mini hypnosis sessions. But there's so many different things that is available to people who want to change their minds, literally. Or the wiring that they're experiencing, which can sometimes, after a lot of negative experiences, be wired towards more negativity, right?
Yeah.
There's so many tools.
It's interesting that you bring that up, because that's a topic that we talk about a lot on this show. I mean, like, a lot, Jessica, is the fact that our brain is so attached to our amygdala. The fear center, the reptilian part of the brain that is utter fight or flight survival response. And our brains are, they're designed to learn from pain. They're designed to learn fire hot. Don't touch it again. It's hard to counteract anything bad that happens, because it's going to have five or six times the effect of something good. And it's going to be rooted in your brain and your psyche so much harder and further down than something good.
Yes, I love that you're saying this because met like 20 years ago or something crazy. I read a book, I think it was called Emotional Intelligence, but it was literally about that. And I had learned back then that the amygdala will basically, even if something reminds you of a negative experience, you will emotionally relive
immediately.
Before the new one even has a chance to happen.
Yep.
Just because it reminds you of that. So that just shows you, like, you really need to get the tools to redirect the neurotransmitters from going in that direction and letting them go, you know, forcing them in another direction.
And if you think that we're crazy, folks, if you think that we're talking some kind of, like, willy-nilly, hippy-dippy hypnotic stuff while I'm holding my crystal in my studio and talking with her, which we are. But here's the thing. This is all science. It's there.
Absolutely.
It's there.
It is.
Every bit of it. And it's strange the way our brain works. If you want a prime example of it, guaranteed every one of you listening at some point has walked into a room, shook hands with somebody and walked out and go, I don't know what it is about that guy. I just don't like him.
Mm-hmm.
Guaranteed. It was the way the hand was shook, the way the room smelled when you met him. Something. There was some kind of olfactory or subharmonic sense, subconscious sense going on that reminded you of a trauma past. That reminded you of somebody that failed you, hurt you in some way, shape, or form, that led to that strange feeling of, I just don't like that guy. Don't know him from Adam. Don't know why.
This is exactly what it is, our traumas. Everybody has a certain level of trauma in different ways, which are severe or less severe to each person based on the person, whatever.
Yeah.
But those traumas unhealed or unaddressed, you know, can lead to a lot of suffering and a lot of negativity, and you can be blocking your own positive path.
Yeah.
You can be in your own way of happiness. So for me, the power of the mind. And believe me, I've been in some really dark places. Same I'm not here. Even going to pretend I haven't. Same I've struggled here. With different types of addictions, you know, maybe not like as severe as certain others, but I've struggled with many things. I've had a lot of failures. I've had to do all of this myself.
Yep.
And it's a choice of saying, I've had enough. I'm going to work on this. Let me find all the tools I can possibly find to pull myself out of this rut, to pull myself out of this negative, constant feeling of negativity, because literally sometimes it really is in your own mind.
It's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Negative, it is. And it's also self-sabotage.
Yep.
At the same time, I see people self-sabotaging all the time. And I've been there. I've done it in the past. And I really try hard to recognize if I'm doing that now and how. And how to step out of it. Luckily, I'm involved in different things where I do know the tools at this point that work for me up until this point. I might have to learn some new ones at some point as well. But it really is a choice, and it really is a matter of identifying what your traumas were and how they affected you and how they're affecting your life right now and your relationships, because I see it affect relationships on a crazy level.
Absolutely, Jessica. And you know what? I'm going to issue this challenge to my audience right now. For all of you out there that are fad dieter, what have you, if you did the Tide Pod challenge, I don't care. that means that you're willing to try something. All right. Out of the ordinary that maybe you would have never considered doing, like throwing a Tide Pod in your mouth and chewing. So here's the thing. It's not going to suck nearly as much as the Tide Pod challenge, but it's going to take you 30 days. All right. What I want you to do is every morning when you wake up, literally say, man, today is going to kick ass. That's it. That's the only thing you have to commit to. That's it. is making your first vibration of the day positive.
Can I add one thing to the challenge?
Go ahead.
Okay. If they could just find one thing to do for 20 minutes, half an hour a day that literally just makes them feel happy, whether it's music, whatever, it could be anything. Just find the time, whatever it does that like makes you feel excited or happy or just in a good mood. Just do that after you tell yourself your day is going to kick ass. It changes your physiological response.
You know what's hilarious is just this morning, because of all the negativity going on, I shared that on Facebook, that exact thing. And I'm pulling it up right now so that I can actively quote myself. I don't quote myself often, but one of my favorite albums in the world is Division Bell by Pink Floyd. And my quote this morning for everybody was, this world is full of horrible, horrible things and monsters all around. Find something that makes you happy. I listen to this album almost every single morning when I am not on the road. It is the equivalent of a warm hug and a cup of coffee to me. It sets me right and reminds me to slow down and take time. Yes, I own a business. Three, technically. Yes, I work 7 days a week. No, there is not a day off. This is my choice through following my passions. But I at least realize I need to stop, breathe, and just contemplate life and my place in it and what I can do to make it better. Find something like this. Find something that makes you pause and reflect, that makes you remember good things, blessings, and what you can do for the world around you. This is what we need. Find your inner peace and silence, and find your passion.
Wow.
That was my message to my audience this morning.
I'm telling you.
And it must make my wife sick to know that. Yeah, like every single morning, I come into my office and that's what I have Alexa play. And it just, it immediately is like a deep breath. And despite anything that's going on, it's like there's still a deep breath going on. Enjoy the deep breath. The day's going to be all right.
Yeah. It,
there's a bunch of crazy emails and we'll get to them. But remember the deep breath. And I think people forget the deep breath. I think people forget that there are good things. I think that people forget that they are a good thing. That they deserve to be a good thing. So
I agree.
Yeah, so many things to talk about. And it's my God, I literally could keep going for hours and hours, but I do not want to keep you. I don't do that to my guests on their first episode, not their first episode. Maybe later we'll get into like 3 hour long episodes, because we've definitely had them with people, where it keeps going, like, and we keep growing as an audience. So, as we do, yeah, I was going to say dang international connections. What did you say actually? Because we did lose you there.
Oh no, I think I was just trying to listen, but I heard a blank spot there, but that's okay.
Yeah. Well, as we do wrap up, please do tell our audience where they can go. It's shameless self-promotion time. Tell them where they can go to book you to come talk to their local high school. Local guys, if you're somebody that wants to help, go talk to your local high school. Get a group of parents together. Bring a speaker like this to your school to talk about it. These are the things that need to happen. Yeah. These are the conversations that we need to have with our youth, with our young adults, and with each other. So tell everybody where they can go to book you, where they can go to see the trailer for the movie, where they can go for hypnotherapy. We definitely want to have you back on to talk about hypnotherapy. Good Lord, I've been trying to find a good hypnotherapist to have on for years. So, shameless self-promotion. Go for it.
I feel like we have many, many topics that we could talk about for hours. So
days,
I think that's amazing.
Days.
And thank you so much for having me on the show. So yeah, guys, I do speak about addiction, obviously. I speak about the opioid epidemic. I do show the 10-minute version of our trailer, which is pretty well like a short film, very intense, raw, realistic view of what this type of addiction looks like. It's not a documentary. It's a drama. It's highly entertaining, but realistic and raw. So that is part of my addiction event. On the flip side, I have events called, an event coming up called Own Your Life, as I mentioned, with Brandon Dawson, my colleague and partner in that. And we are writing a book together about resilience, again, about overcoming obstacles, owning your life. So I will be personally doing mini hypno sessions at the end of those events, and you can contact me via my personal email. It's jessicagpetrovich@gmail.com. It's jessicagpetrovich@gmail.com. You can post the link, Chris.
They will be posted.
Okay, perfect. And the website where you can view the 2-minute trailer of the 16 film is www.the16movie.com. I think that pretty much sums it up. Any inquiries about hypnosis or events, like I said, just contact me directly and I'll get back to you real quickly.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for coming on, talking about this important and more than pressing topic facing our society, facing humanity in our world in general. Just the number of executives that have been called to the table lately that have been, I mean, good Lord, even the vice president not too long ago had to cancel his trip to New Hampshire because he was going to be shaking hands with the head of a drug company that was being called before the DEA.
Yeah.
For selling mass quantities of opiates illegally. So wild. It affects everything. It's everywhere. So we will definitely have you back on for movie updates. We definitely want to have you back on to talk with our audience about hypnotherapy and what that's all about. We talk about binaural beats and things like that on the regs on this show. So we would definitely love to have you back on. Please do hold the line for just one moment as we close things out. Jessica, once again, thank you so much for coming on, sharing your vast realm of experience and knowledge in the advocacy realm against opioids, as well as your passion for life, for everything, and for the movie 16. We definitely want to help support you in that effort to get that made.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate the opportunity, and this was, you know, really great to talk to you, and you're, you know, so involved in a lot of these topics already. So I look forward to coming back as well.
Absolutely. Please do hold the line real quick. While you were on the line or online checking out all the great work of Jessica Gerlich, make sure to go and check out the Dudes and Beer podcast. Dudesandbeerpodcast.com is where you can find it. You can also find our links there to Audible. If you're a fan of audiobooks like me and just don't have time to turn a page, go check out Audible. Audibletrial.com/dudes will get you 30 free days. Guaranteed you will love it. While you're online doing that, make sure to check out our parent network, the HC Universal Network. Great new shows there. Rebecca Sounds Reveille, welcome to the family. Magus Elgar, if you're a nerd like me, you will love Magus Elgar. It's an audio journey, Terry Pratchett style. Hugely hilarious. Till next time, everybody, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and remember, if you can't be good at it. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Dudes and Beer Podcast. To listen to our audio streams or chat with us live, download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets. For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody, and until next time, drink responsibly.